Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The history that's told in textbooks or documentaries only tells part of the story. The blanks are filled by oral histories. One organization has been collecting Latino voices for the last quarter century. The Voces Oral History Center at the University of Texas at Austin began documenting and preserving the stories of Latino World War II veterans in 1999. Its scope has expanded to include the voices of over 1,800 Latinos across various other topics and eras.
In 1944, as soon as I graduated, I volunteered to go in the Army.
Young students drove by with their windows rolled down and called us wetbacks and told us to go back to Mexico or whatever. And so I found that, you know, after fighting in Vietnam, I'd be, you know, faced with racial slurs like that.
The way I ended up in mariachi was just through circumstance. I started as a folklorico dancer.
Voces has been under the direction of its founder, Dr. Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, from the start. She joins us today to explain how Voces came to be and how it plans to mark its 25th anniversary.
Voces began in 1999 as a result, really, of a gap in the literature about Latinos of the World War II generation and their contributions to civil rights. I had been a newspaper reporter before I became professor, and I did a magazine story earlier. And when I was doing this magazine story about, you know, civil rights and that generation of Mexican Americans, which was so important because they were the ones who began MALDEF, they began the GI Forum, they brought new life into LULAC. They were just this amazing group of men and women who had been subjected to all sorts of discrimination and said, that doesn't make sense. This is our country too. So I was really enthralled by those stories. And when I was doing my magazine piece years earlier, I couldn't find a single book about that. And so I knew about oral history. So when I got to UT Austin, I was allowed to teach this class any way I wanted, and I chose to do it this way. So we started off with World War II, and we did that for the first 10 years. It was always, has always been national in scope, and it's always included men and women. So it's not strictly, it wasn't only about the men and women in uniform. We also included civilians, because anybody who's lived through a period of war knows that the war affects not just the people in uniform, but it also affects those people back home. Mm-hmm. And so for World War II, we wanted to make sure that we got the stories of the women who had waited for their husbands and the women who worked there in San Antonio, you know, Rosita the Riveters, the Kelly Cadys. After 10 years, we expanded to the Korean and Vietnam War period. The thread that ran through a lot of these interviews was civil rights. Political and civic engagement became a separate collection because this was also the generation, and even the Vietnam War generation, they were the generations that had the first elected official from X county or from X city, the first person to serve on the school boards, and those kinds of things. So we wanted to make sure to record those interviews as well. So political and civic engagement, and now we have one on professions, one on arts and culture. People have started to donate their interviews to us as well. So we have people like Jesus Treviño, who's a pretty famous film director in Los Angeles. He donated 125 of his interviews that he's done with Latinos and Latinas around the country, particularly actors, artists, writers. So he's donated his interviews, and we keep on getting new donations of interviews. It's people hear about what we do. I'm feeling kind of reflective at this point, and I'm feeling very grateful to those people when we first started out that believed in what we were doing. And it was never a question of begging people to be interviewed. They understood the importance of what we were doing, and they were so patient with us. You know, they were so patient with us as we were trying to figure out how these cameras worked or the microphones and stuff, and they just sat very patiently and talked to us and were really amazing people. So I'm immensely grateful to them and to their families for all they've meant to us.
There's been so much growth in the last 25 years. When you started in 1999, has it become what you imagined it to be?
Norma, I wish that I had the imagination. I hate to say it, but I really was just so focused on just getting these stories with the World War II generation. I was not thinking about what's going to happen when this part of the project is over. All I knew is, because from the very beginning, people would say, this is great that you're doing it about the World War II generation, but when are you going to expand to the Vietnam generation in particular? And I would say, whenever we get enough money, we'll expand. And that's really as far as I could see it, because it was such a struggle. We got a very small stipend from the state, and then everything else was volunteers and my students. I would pay my students, but I had a lot of volunteers working on this. So if it wasn't for my students doing a lot of the interviews at the beginning, we wouldn't have gotten any. So anyway, long story short is that's as far as I could see, because my parameters were, I knew what the capacity was for us to be able to use this money wisely. And then after that, I didn't really have another way, except for getting grants and that sort of thing. I didn't have another way of expanding.
You mentioned the students, and your students, as you mentioned, bore really the brunt of a lot of the hard work that you did. Did it help being on the campus of a university that you were able to pull from these students who might not even have imagined they'd be doing this work? Did the fact that it was inside of an institution, did that kind of help promote or grow the project more than you had imagined?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I can say with all honesty that had it not been that we were at a university, we would not be here today, because I taught a class. My class was called Oral History as Journalism. So my students would learn about World War II, and they would learn about oral history and that sort of thing. And then they would do one or two interviews, and we would travel to different places. We went to San Antonio a couple of times. We went to Brownsville, Laredo, Houston, El Paso, and we would travel and we would do 2 days of very intense interviews. And if it weren't for my students doing those interviews, at the end of the day, at the end of the weekend, we could come back with as many as 20 interviews. That's a lot of interviews. And so my students were really working very hard, doing the interviews, scanning photographs. And that's the other part of it is, besides the interviews, we have thousands and thousands of historical photographs and documents that we've scanned. So they did all of that, and we would never have been able to do that. And even if you look at our website, the short version is voicescenter.org. You can scan and you can look for all the World War II stories we've done. There's summaries based on the interviews. So my students, not only in this class, but that also was bigger than that. I had students in my reporting classes and in other professors' reporting classes writing stories based on the interviews that then we would do side-by-side edits, and that's what went up on our website.
So, I mean, 1999, to me at least, is not that long ago. But again, these are students who they've had this technology and they've grown up with this technology. How has the growth and the spurt in technology in these last 25 years helped make your project easier?
Well, some things have remained the same, like the scanning. So we still use portable scanners, and we attach them to computers and we scan them at high resolution. That has not changed. What has changed is when we first started off, we used Hi8 cameras and we used inexpensive external microphones. Now we use really good high definition digital cameras. Gosh, I remember this so well. So there was one time I was doing an interview in El Paso, and there was this man who was a pilot during World War II. And normally the interviews were an hour, hour and a half, but I didn't bring enough Hi8 tape. So I had to keep on getting my brother to run to the store to buy more Hi8 tapes because we kept on running out. And these days you put everything on a little SD cards, and these SD cards have a huge capacity. So you don't ever have to change out the SD cards. So that's been really having the digital, not having to convert it. I mean, when we first started, we would get the interviews on Hi8. And then we would take them and they would transfer them to a VHS tape. And then we would look at the VHS tape. We'd send a copy of that VHS tape to the interview subject. And then we would use that VHS tape to write the story so that we would have a good something to base it on. Yeah, so that part of it has changed a lot. And these days, you know, we get the SD cards. We have high resolution, high definition video, but we also make a little file, a more compressed file, and that's what we use so that we can put that on our YouTube channel. That's the other thing. I'm glad you brought that up. So we have a YouTube channel. If you go to YouTube and you look up Voices Oral History Center, you'll see dozens and dozens and dozens of our interviews based on the different collections. So a few years ago, right before the pandemic, in fact, in March of 2020, we were in San Antonio doing interviews with mariachis. All of those mariachi interviews are on there. You know, we have the capability of putting easily, just being able to push a button, and then we can have those available to people if they give us permission to do that.
And the students who have been involved in helping you gather all this information since the very beginning, I was looking on the website and there is a page where it's like a virtual homecoming, and a few of them have shared their stories. And I'm looking and I'm doing the math, and these students should now be in their 40s. I can't imagine, you know, what that must feel like to you, remembering them as young students, maybe in their late teens, early 20s, and hearing how Voices still continues to make an impact in their lives. Have any of them shared exactly how Voices may have impacted maybe the trajectory of their lives or careers?
Only when we've asked them, usually. I mean, once in a while I get a note from someone who's a very nice note who says how it's affected them. But when we started doing the virtual homecomings, I really had no idea, particularly for the students who came from, I have two women students who came from Mexico, and I had no idea what it had meant to them. There has been a kind of a divide between U.S.-born Mexican-Americans and Mexicans. Folks from Mexico not understanding why a lot of us don't speak Spanish on this side, and it's because we were not encouraged to speak Spanish because of kind of traditional discrimination against our parents and grandparents. And then those on our side of the border just not understanding what it's taken for folks to make that migration. Hearing them talk about that and hearing them talk about how this gave them an understanding of what the Mexican-American experience was like, that history, they would never have gotten it any other way. And it did bridge that gap. And for one of them, she talked about how she felt that it gave her a home on campus, that she didn't feel like she fit in anyplace else. But when she was at, then it was not called Voices, it was called the U.S. Latino and Latina World War II Oral History Project. When she was there in our offices, she felt like she had a home away from home. I did not know that. You know, I've got to tell you that now I have those students of that first generation. They have kids now in college. Two of them have kids here at UT. That really does blow my mind. I feel like a grandmother now.
Maggie Rivas Rodriguez is the founder and director of the Voices Oral History Center at the University of Texas at Austin. When we come back, now is a good time to collect an oral history, because one day it will be too late.
We say, oh, I'm going to get to that. And the idea is, when the conditions are perfect, I'm going to get to that. And conditions are very rarely perfect. So if you want to do it now.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The Voices Oral History Center at the University of Texas at Austin has collected over 1,800 oral histories from Latinos that shed light on their contributions to U.S. history. It started with the Latino World War II veterans in 1999 and has expanded in the last 25 years to include interviews with Latino veterans of other conflicts like Vietnam and Korea, with civil rights figures, and with stories from a recent tragedy, the COVID-19 pandemic. The Voces Oral History Center marks its 25th anniversary with a special event this month. It features panel discussions, a roundtable, a photo display, and an interview booth for people who want to chronicle their histories. Its founder and director, Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, says the celebration November 16th will recognize the past and explore current and future efforts of the center.
So the part about where we're coming from, we've been doing interviews about the South Texas Border Initiative, which was this legislative bill that gave millions and millions of dollars to colleges and universities in South Texas and on the border. And we're looking at that and saying, you know, how did it come about? But more importantly, where are we today? Where is that area today? And how has it evolved? So we're having one panel discussion about that. And we're having another panel discussion with the participation of people whose parents we've interviewed. So for a lot of the people that we've interviewed, someone was telling me that they were listening to their father's interview and they said, I never knew that he had gone through that. And we hear that over and over again. Sometimes they've never been asked the questions, but also it's almost like the time was right and they were finally opening up and telling folks about it. So we want to hear more from them about how their parents' experience, particularly during World War II, how that affected them and what kind of trajectory it's helped them on in their own careers. And then the other, we're having a roundtable. The roundtable will feature people who will talk about different efforts at the local levels, at the state levels, and at the national level of ongoing efforts to restore, to celebrate, to recognize Latino history and culture. That's going to not just talk about what's being done now, but hopefully, what I'm really hoping, and I think that it's happened every time I've been to a conference, some of what people hear at the roundtables and the panel discussions will inspire others to do their own work in this area. One of the people who's coming is going to be from Dallas. Dallas has a Mexican American Historical League. And these people have been working for years on doing oral histories and getting exhibits and doing everything they can to recognize their local history. So I'm hoping that other people say, well, you know, they're doing that in Dallas. We should be able to do that in Austin or San Antonio, or they're doing it in San Antonio. San Antonio actually has a very, very vibrant community of people who do this work. But I'm hoping that other people will say, well, we should be doing that. There's no reason we can't do that. And they'll be able to get at least that roadmap that other people have laid out.
And, you know, oral histories do have a time limit, and that's people's lifetimes. And so the sooner you can preserve those stories, that's probably for the sake of posterity, because nobody is going to know about those stories if nobody asks.
Thank you for saying that, because, you know, a lot of times we all, and we do this, we say, oh, I'm going to get to that. And the idea is, when the conditions are perfect, I'm going to get to that. And conditions are very rarely perfect. So if you want to do it now. Even if you don't have the best equipment possible, even if you don't, you only have an hour that you can do this in. Most of our interviews are about 2 hours long. Even if the conditions are not perfect, go ahead and do it, because who knows, it may be the last time that you have a chance to do it.
What you were talking about earlier about that panel where you're going to have the children of the parents who were interviewed, how many times they never knew. And I'm wondering if you have come across, and I'm sure you have, interview subjects who have never told the story, maybe because they never really wanted to share it with family members, but maybe sharing it with a stranger might allow them to be even more honest and less perhaps nervous about telling the truth about maybe what may have happened in their lifetime?
Maybe that may be part of it. And I think another part of it is when you're in an interview, and all of our interviews are videotaped, you know, very few interviews are just audio, although there's nothing wrong with audio. And I think audio is a great way to go if you get great audio. You're there with a video camera and your interview subject and maybe the videographer, and all you're thinking about in that moment, you're almost in this little cocoon. And there's something about just that attention. You're giving this person your full attention, and you're not thinking about what you're going to cook for dinner. You are really spending that time thinking about this person and asking them the follow-up questions. I do think that that makes them look at themselves in a different way. And I think that whenever we see our loved ones, those interviews, I think it helps us to see them in a different way, not just as my dad or my uncle. It helps us to see them as, oh my God, that man was a young person just like I was. My mother was, at one point, she was even younger than I was, and she was doing these remarkable things. How did she ever have the bravery to do something like that? So I think that in that moment, I think that people kind of start to get the feedback that what they're saying is important, and it helps them kind of open up a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. But it's hard to have these conversations after dinner. You're sitting there after dinner and you start talking about their wartime experience, and there's always the clock ticking, and you need to get the dishes washed and the leftovers put away, whatever. I do think there's something kind of magical about that very intense one-on-one experience where you're there with that person.
Well, I'm going to go so far as to say that Vosis is probably your baby, and your baby's all grown up. He's 25. What do the next 25 years look like?
I think it's time for some new eyes and some new brain cells to kick around. We have a lot of people involved in Vosis, so it's the baby now has many mothers and many fathers. Thank goodness. But we are doing things like, you know, we publish an annual journal, and we're looking for a new editor for the journal. So that's one thing that we're doing. And we're looking at what's going to be the next step for Vosis. At some point, I will retire. So I'm looking at where might Vosis go after that. But we have some things that are in place. But I also think that whoever comes in next should use their own fresh thinking, their fresh ideas, to take it to a new level that I could not envision, new directions that I can't envision, and hopefully we can do that. I will say, though, in the near term, I just got a grant to work on some Vietnam vet interviews. So we're going to be doing Vietnam vet interviews in the coming year. We have all kinds of things, other activities that we have, like we have a summer institute for academics, and we do a collaborative fellowship, mostly for academics, but we go to different places, and working with the Center for Mexican American Studies on campus, we'll do interviews about a specific topic. So last summer, we went to Hebronville and did interviews about the Colegio Altamirano, and that was headed by Phyllis Barragan, who's there at Texas A&M San Antonio. So that is one thing I should say is, you know, Vosis is, it's based here at UT Austin, but it's not, this is much bigger than UT Austin, and it's much bigger than any one person. We collaborate across the country with different scholars and academics and community people that are not at UT Austin, not even at UT Systems College. They're at Texas A&M there in San Antonio. And I think it's important to recognize that we're really looking at creating that historical primary source materials about the Latino community in a way that is beyond the borders of our own campuses and our state. And we're really trying to build something that's going to be really useful and meaningful for many generations to come.
Dr. Maggie Rivas Rodriguez is the founder and director of the Vosis Oral History Center at the University of Texas at Austin. She also teaches oral history as journalism at UT's Moody College of Communications School of Journalism. Vosis celebrates its 25th anniversary with a special event Saturday, November 16th at the Eder Harbin Alumni Center on the UT campus. Events include a panel on the South Texas Border Initiative that enhanced access to higher education to Latinos on the South Texas border. Another panel explores Latino war experiences and family legacies in the Vosis Project. A special roundtable will focus on redressing historical omissions. Registration closes Monday, November 4th. Day of registration takes place November 16th, but with increased fees. Register at vosis@25.org. That's vosesat25.org. A link to register is also online at tpr.org. We have a link to almost 900 pages of Vosis story collections and to the Vosis YouTube channel at tpr.org. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Maria Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.